Welcome to Inside Analog Photo. I'm your host, Scott Shepard, and the Inside Analog Photography radio program is brought to you by Fujifilm, making life more colorful. They have great instant film, the Instax here in the U.S., Chrome, Neg, black and white, paper, tons of great stuff. Check them out over at www.fujifilmusa.com/professional. Our friends over at Richard Photo Lab, the place to send all of your Neg, Chrome, black and white, digital files. They can take care of everything for you. Killer Lab in Hollywood, California. Check them out, www.richardphotolab.com. Our friends over at Upstrap at upstrap-pro.com for the camera strap that will not let the camera slide off your shoulder. Killer Gear, check them out. Great stuff. And of course, our media partners of the Analog Photography User Group over at www.apug.org, the place on the net to talk about all things traditional photographic processes. Great stuff going on with those guys. You can learn anything you want to know over at APUG. We got a great show lined up everybody today. We have with us the legendary color printer, Katine. Katine is going to talk about his process, what's going on, the state of dye transfer printing in the U.S. and the world, and just a lot of cool stuff going on. Katine, how you doing today?
Well, I'm doing fine. It's a nice sunny day here in Daly City, which is unusual. This is Fog City, after all.
It is, and it's very interesting this time of year. The weather's so good. We're lucky.
Exactly.
So, Katine, tell me how you got into photography itself. You've been doing this for quite a while. You have some beautiful artwork on your website. You're considered by a lot of people as the finest color printer ever have done printing. Let's talk about how you got involved in all of this analog photography. I know you've been doing digital stuff for a long time too, electronic printing, a lot of cool stuff you're up to, but let's talk about how you got involved in photography to start with.
Well, before I do, I want to correct one thing, which is, yes, some people have said I'm the finest color printer around. There were folks at Kodak who says I'm the best dye transfer printer who's ever been out there. And I actually disagree with all those folks because I know printers who are better than I am. I wish I were as good as they are. If you ever get a chance, talk to Joe Holmes. The guy is brilliant. And I could name several others. I'll be happily considered in the top 10, okay?
Joe's really great. You know, Joe's really into the whole digital stuff. In fact, I just saw some prints from Joe last week in Atlanta.
Joe also was long into analog. He taught me tricks I could never have imagined.
Wow.
Anyway, I just want to say there's a lot of good printers out there. And one of the wonderful things about the web is that we're finding out about all sorts of people out there who are doing neat stuff that we never knew. Previously, you didn't get exposed to somebody unless they were in your neighborhood or they got published in a national venue.
Right, but like you said, with the web, people go onto forums or onto APUG or this place or that place, and it's like, wow, look what he's doing with this.
Yes, you discover someone on the other side of the planet who's doing really fabulous stuff. I just recently found out about a guy in one of the Eastern European countries. I made a bookmark, so I can't tell you which one. I forget these things. You know, who's doing some lovely stuff with eclipse photography that I'm interested in. I'm going to have to email him. I would have never known about his stuff otherwise. Yeah, the web helps a lot. Anyway, I got started in all of this was, I've always been interested in photography, even as a kid, but I was actually no good at it. That's an objective statement. I got curious some years ago and went back and looked at the old family albums to see what my photographs looked like. Because I was always the one carrying around a little box camera and things like that. And if you think about what film and print processing was like in the 1950s and 1960s, which was really awful, it's entirely possible there were some really nice photos in there that just never had decent prints of them made. So I thought it'd be interesting to go back, you know, look at the childhood photos of Katine and see what was in there. It's garbage. It's truly garbage. There's no redeeming social value to them whatsoever. They're the most banal, ordinary, awful photographs you could imagine. And that lasted up until my mid-teens. And then my grandfather gave me a Polaroid land camera, one of the old roll film kinds, the Highlander, for people who like to collect these things, the one that made little roll film Polaroid pictures.
Right.
And that got me hooked. And it was the feedback. It was the ability to make a photograph and see what came out immediately. Given that I've got this scientific turn of mind and I'm a pretty good experimentalist, I very quickly got into this whole idea of, okay, that didn't work right. What if I varied this? What if I changed that? And that's how I started climbing the learning curve really fast. So over a span of probably a year and a half, I turned from being a completely awful photographer, and I don't just mean technically, I mean aesthetically, just uninteresting, into doing photographs that were halfway decent. And it was all because of Polaroid. I became hooked on Polaroid for some years. I quickly bought myself the large roll film Polaroid camera so that I could start playing with color and infrared and high speed and all those other cool things. Then I used my graduation money from high school to buy one of the ColorPack cameras, the high-end ColorPack model, that let me play with even more cool stuff and did a little bit with a view camera with a Polaroid back. I was pretty much a Polaroid fanatic until the middle of college. Did everything that way. It was a fabulous learning tool, and I actually produced a handful of really good photographs along the way. These days, I tell people digital's like the new Polaroid. You want someone to learn how to do photography? Just have them make pictures and look at the results. It's a great learning tool. Anyway, it also taught me a couple of other things, which is it taught me to be very frugal with my photographs. If you can imagine a high school student in the 1960s buying Polaroid film on their allowance, you know, I was lucky if I could afford 5 or 6 photographs a week. So I got really, really good at not wasting any of them.
That's the thing, too, with digital is once you've got the equipment, you can shoot as much as you want. And I think people that have shot digital and go back to film, they say, well, now this is going to cost me so much a shot, and they slow down. And I think film makes you think more about what you're going to compose and what you're going to do for that shot. You're not going to burn it off like you're shooting digital.
Exactly. Digital lets you experiment, and that's really wonderful. Film, you learn how to be really careful with it, and this stood me in pretty good stead later. I ended up learning how to make photographs the way someone using a view camera would. Every single photograph counted. That doesn't mean that all of mine were successful, but I never, ever was the kind of photographer who simply burnt film for the sake of burning film. In fact, I would say as a professional, in most years, I made fewer than 1,000 photographs. I know amateurs who made more film photographs than that in a weekend.
Yeah.
But I can look at my collection of negatives. I know how big it is. And I can tell you, nope, less than 1,000. Some years only a few hundred. Some years more. A very high percentage of those were keepers.
That's the big thing. Yeah. Keepers versus garbage.
Exactly. Anyway, I suppose all of that kind of set me up for dye transfer. I got into color because it interested me in college. I quickly discovered that color films at the time were nothing to brag about. This is in the late 1960s, mind you. And I was interested in prints, so that took me to color negative film instead of slides, because slide printing was even worse. So really, it's all been, in a sense, art-driven. I know I'm known as the supreme technical geek, but it's all been art-driven. I wanted to make photographs that I really liked. I wanted to make prints I really liked. So it took me in the direction of color negative film. It took me in the direction of medium format, because 35mm color negative films were just sucky beyond words at that point.
Yeah, yep.
Got me a little bit into large format, and eventually I decided that was too big and bulky to carry around. The classic dictum, which is the camera that makes the best photographs, is the one you actually have with you. And a view camera was not something I typically had with me.
So that's one thing I learned from Jay Mazel was never leave the building without a camera.
Mm-hmm.
And I take that to heart every day. I don't go anywhere without a camera. And like you said, no matter what you have, you got to have a camera. You can't take the photo.
And if you look over the history of my reviews in the magazines, you'll discover that I've reviewed a certain number of point-and-shoots and compact cameras along the way, the sort of things that supposed professionals would never be caught dead with. And the reason is because those are cameras I could always have with me. When Fuji came out with their GA645, the completely automated medium format camera, that you could also use in a complete manual mode as well.
Right.
I tested that and I instantly bought one, because it was only a little bigger than a 35mm SLR. It gave me medium format, and I would take it with me everywhere. Day's compact digital feels the same way. I've had a lot of fun with that. And I reviewed point-and-shoots in my time, both film and digital, for much the same reason. I like a camera that I can carry around with me. And honest to God, packing a Pentax 67 everywhere just isn't my idea of fun anymore. Back in college, don't ask me why.
You're more prone to be a little more enthusiastic and go through a little bit more pain.
Enthusiasm is a nice, delicate word for it, yeah. That was the one that came to my mind.
I'm assuming now you're carrying a digital camera with you, correct?
Yeah, as a matter of fact. In fact, I hate to say it, but I haven't made any film photographs for myself, other than for test purposes, in about 2 years. And I don't know what that means. I haven't decided I've given up film. I've got a freezer full of film. I still have all my medium format film camera equipment, but I don't seem to be taking it out. I have a nasty feeling there's a sea change going on. On the other hand, I'm in no rush to do anything about it. It may be that indeed I'm starting to move over. This would be no great loss. I would point out that like most photographers of any quality whatsoever, I have far more negatives than I will ever have time to print in my life. This is a known problem. Go read the biographies and autobiographies of any of the photographers, and they always had tons of stuff they never got to print. Adams had this problem, vinaigrette to excess. And I've got the same thing. If I never made a new photograph for the rest of my life in any medium, I could still spend the entire rest of my life printing the ones I've already made. So it's not like I'm giving up film for digital or vice versa. But for some reason, I'm not being drawn to making new film photographs. And that may just be the new toy factor. Who knows? In 2 or 3 years, I might be back doing film.
At least you have the stuff. You have the cameras. You have film.
Exactly. And I am absolutely not getting rid of any of it because I'm not that kind of absolutist about this stuff. I don't feel like I have to take a stand and establish a position with what I'm doing. I do wherever the muse takes me.
If you think about it, a camera is a tool. Depending on what the job is, you want to use the best tool for the best job to get the job done. And like you said, digital is amazing technology. You can make some really cool stuff from digital. You can intermix the two. You can do analog capture with digital output that I think we'll talk about here in a bit because you've been making electronic prints for decades.
Exactly. And in fact, I have done both ways for making most of my digital prints. In fact, I'm working from film. I really haven't done a lot in the way of digital capture. I hate that phrase, but let's use it for technical purposes. I haven't done much in the way of digital capture that has made me really happy yet. I'm still playing with that. There's a little stuff out there. So mostly what I'm doing is I'm taking film and scanning it and producing digital prints from that. Conversely, I can go from electronic files, have negatives written out on a film writer, and make dye transfers from digital files. And I've done that also.
Wow.
Frankly, it's an easier way to go than doing it in the darkroom. I like doing it in the darkroom better because of the hands-on aspect. But believe me, not having to make all those nasty separations and masks in the darkroom, it's a lot easier to have a computer do all of that. That's the grunt work.
Well, you can relax in a nice office and sit in a comfy chair and do that in Photoshop.
Precisely. But it's not the way I think. That I'm used to all my photography being hands-on craft. It's just the way I've always worked. I've always done all my own printing. I've always had my own equipment. The idea of sending a photograph out to be printed at a custom lab isn't the way I think, because I'm a custom lab. And in the same vein, sending a file out to a custom bureau to have a negative written, which then they'll mail back to me, just isn't the way I think of working. It's a psychological block. There's no reason why I shouldn't be doing it. I'm just used to doing everything myself. Anyway, back to your original question, which is, so I got into color. I got into doing color negative. I got pretty good at doing color negative, and then in the mid-70s, a viewer of an exhibition of my photos looked at the stuff and smiled at me and said, "You do lovely work. I'd love to get some good prints of it." Understand, at that point, I was already a pretty good printer, a much, much, much better than average printer. So I figured that this person either was a real jerk, or he knew something about printing that I didn't know. So I gambled on the latter, and it turned out he knew something about printing I didn't know, and that was dye transfer. And over a period of about 2 years, he finally bludgeoned me into doing dye transfer for him, so he could buy some really nice prints. And it was an uphill battle, because I'd only vaguely heard of dye transfer. I'd never even seen a dye transfer print. And I was pretty well convinced I couldn't do it, and he just kept slogging away and finally convinced me to learn how to do it. And to make a very long story short, I learned how to do it.
So let's talk about this. Let's talk about this dye transfer printing. People hear dye transfer now. They think of dye sublimation, electronic type printing, and I guess it's almost sort of the same type of process.
Not even close, and I have to keep correcting this all the time. It's an unfortunate confluence of terms, but that's life. Dye transfer printing isn't anything like dye sublimation printing. They're entirely different ways of approaching it. I can describe dye transfer printing pretty simply. I'll do it by analogy first for your listeners who are familiar with it. It's the darkroom equivalent of four-color press printing. On a four-color press, you take your original photograph, you make separations from it, you then make screened plates from that, you coat those plates with oil-based ink, and you impress them onto a sheet of paper, one after another. That's how you get the cyan, magenta, yellow, and black. And you put them all together, and you get a color print impression on paper. Dye transfer is an analogous process in the darkroom, except it's continuous tone photographic. There aren't any screens involved. And it uses water-based dyes instead of oil-based inks. The process essentially goes like this. You start out with some kind of original. It could be black and white in-camera separations. It could be a color slide. It could be a color negative. Or, as I said, it could even be a digital file. From this, you need to get red, green, and blue light separations. And there are a couple of ways to approach that. But the ultimate result of this is that you take three sheets of something called matrix film. which was a product Kodak made and nobody else, you make exposures onto those sheets of matrix film for each of the red, green, and blue images that you have. When you develop the matrix film in the right way, you end up with a printing plate. You end up with a relief image in gelatin. The thickness of the emulsion that's left on the film is proportional to the amount of light that hit the film. So you not only have a big sheet film photographic image, you actually have something you can use as a printing plate.
Wow.
You take each of those matrices and you soak it in a tray of dye, the complementary color. Red matrix goes in the cyan dye, etc., etc. And the gelatin soaks up dye. The more light that hit the matrix film, the thicker the gelatin. The thicker the gelatin, the more dye it absorbs. The more dye it absorbs, the darker the print. So there you go. More light hits the film, you end up with darker image in the print. It's your ordinary negative process. More light makes a darker picture. Except getting there is a very long process.
Let's sort of go through that so people can actually know the painstaking amount of work that you have to do to make these dye transfer prints, because, of course, we just went over the process real lightly, but let's start off with a medium format negative. I have something I shot with my Fuji GA645. I have a nice piece of 645 color neg film. What do you do from there when you have this thing that's developed? You have a piece of film.
Well, I've got a bit of advantage because I've got something called pan matrix film. Kodak made two kinds of matrix film, regular ortho blue light sensitive stuff and something called pan matrix film, which was sensitive to all colors of light. I can make my separations directly onto pan matrix from a color negative. I don't have to go through the intermediate separation stages. This makes the process a lot more reliable. I'm not saying it's better because it gives you different kinds of controls, but it's definitely easier. So I'll take that color negative and I'll clean it, and boy, will I clean it carefully. Because let me tell you, anything that gets on those matrices, you have to spot in every single print thereafter. So I'll clean the negative to a fairly well, put it in the enlarger, set it up to make a print of the final size I want, and run a bunch of tests. We'll skip over the tedious process of making test strips. Everyone knows that test strips are tedious. You have to do it in dye transfer also. Anyway, I have a set of color separation filters. They're rattan gelatins, red, green, and blue. And to make the cyan printer, I'll put a red filter in the light path and expose a sheet of pan matrix film. The amount of time I expose the pan matrix film determines how much of that color I get. For people who've done tricolor printing on conventional color materials, you can think of it as being a lot like that, except this is all going on to three different sheets of material instead of one sheet of material. So I'll take the one sheet of matrix film and expose it through the red filter. I'll put another sheet of matrix film down, expose it through a green filter, another one through a blue filter. This all has to be done in register, mind you. So the enlarger has to be locked down. The negative can't shift in the carrier. You use a pin register easel. That's an easel that has little pins in it that fit into holes that you punch in the film so that it locks the film into a specific position on the easel. The easel's actually a vacuum easel that's hooked up to a vacuum pump so that it holds the film down tight. All of this has to be done or else you'll get misregistration between the different colors. And as I said, the negative has to be meticulously clean because any speck of dust on it will produce an image on those matrices. Then that'll be there for the rest of your life, and you really don't want that. That's how you make the exposures. It's not terribly different than exposing normal materials, except you're working in total darkness, and pan matrix film is the most sensitive material anyone's ever used in a darkroom. Light leaks and light scattering from the enlarger that wouldn't matter for any other kind of printing will fog pan matrix film. So you get really, really good at catching all those little light leaks, and it's one of the reasons I have a black darkroom. Anyway, so now I've got three sheets of exposed film. They get developed in something called tanning developer, which is a pyro formulation developer. Good old pyro, classic material. Pyro does two things. It not only stains a silver emulsion, but it also hardens it. And that's the part we care about, is the hardening part. Because matrix film has an unhardened emulsion. To explain what that is, normal gelatin, the kind you get in Knox gelatin or Jell-O brand desserts, is unhardened gelatin. You put it in hot water, it dissolves pretty easily. To harden gelatin, for normal photographic films, you treat it chemically so that it doesn't melt in hot water. Normally, if you had an unhardened emulsion and you stick it, for instance, in 100-degree water, like you would use for processing color film these days, you put unhardened gelatin in that water and it's going to dissolve. You put hardened gelatin in and it's just fine. Matrices are coated with unhardened gelatin. If you wash the sheet of film in hot water, the emulsion just washes right down the drain. So, we've got this tanning developer, and we've got this matrix film. And when you develop the matrix film in the tanning developer, it hardens the emulsion. And the amount of emulsion that it hardens depends on how much light hit the film. Areas that didn't get any exposure, they don't get any development action at all. There's no hardening that goes on. Areas that got a lot of exposure, there's a lot of gelatin that gets hardened during development. You're also getting the staining action, but you don't care about that. You only care about the tanning action.
Because like you said, this is going to be used as like a printing plate. You're not going to actually use this as a... You don't care what color it is.
Precisely. It doesn't matter what it looks like. It's a printing plate. So now at this point, we've got an emulsion, a developed sheet of film. That all has to be done in the dark. This film is in the fixer. Now we can turn on the room lights, thank God. Because let me tell you, working with large sheets of black and white film with a soft, unhardened emulsion in the dark is not a lot of fun. This is really where the craft comes in. It takes practice to be able to do this without messing anything up. It's not a difficult process to teach someone. It's a really hard process to learn to do well. Think about it. You want to make a 16 by 20 print? You're talking about a sheet of film that's a little over 16 by 20 inches. You're talking about developing three of them. You're talking about developing them all identically, or you'll end up with color shifts and color mottle over the surface of the print. And you're talking about not crimping them or scratching them or anything else, and you're doing this all in the dark, pitch darkness. One point I did consider investing in a pair of infrared goggles and an infrared light, and I just decided it was too much of a hassle to deal with. It's that much of a pain. Anyway, so now the room lights are back on, and you look at the tray with the processed matrix film in it, and it doesn't really look like anything. There's this emulsion, and you can see a faint image in it, and not much else. What you do now is you wash those sheets of film in hot water, 125, 130 degree water. And when you wash them in the hot water, all the unhardened emulsion melts away, and it leaves behind only the hardened emulsion, the stuff that got tanned during development. And that's how you get your printing plate out of it.
Now, how thick would I say that what's left after you've washed away the unhardened emulsion? Are we talking 2 or 3 mil? Is it real thick or is it very faint, very light?
It's pretty thick. It's, for an emulsion, it's very, very thick. In fact, pan matrix film has a thick enough emulsion that Kodak had to coat it in two passes. It has a visible relief. You can feel it with your finger. So it's several mils thick.
Now, once you've made these three separations for red, blue, green, when you start doing the printing process, does the pan matrix film actually have some life to it? Can you make a bunch of prints off a separation, or is it good for just a certain duration and then it just starts going away?
That's a really good question. I would imagine it has some life, and I'm about to find out because I'm working on a really large printing job. I'll get to that in a bit. Typically, you should be able to pull a couple of hundred prints from a set of matrices. At some point, I would imagine you start to smush out the gelatin just because of the physical process of squeegeeing down prints. Hasn't happened yet. A bigger problem usually is that you're always handling these big floppy wet sheets of film, and you have to be really, really careful not to scratch them, because you can always spot the scratch out later. But you're going to have to spot the scratch out later. And once you've scratched or damaged a matrix, that mark is there forever. It's like a dust speck in a negative that you can't remove. You will be spotting it out of every single print you make from then on. So I think far more often for people, the lifetime of a matrix is limited by the point at which the spotting just becomes too onerous. Spotting is a big part of making a clean dye transfer print. They don't come off looking as pristine as a machine-made modern print does. You have to do a lot of work after printing to clean them up to get them to look that good. I spend a lot more time spotting a print than I do making one in the darkroom.
So there's what you would equal to modern post-production. You don't have Photoshop, you're spotting.
Exactly. Anyway, you've got these big sheets of matrix film. After you've processed them and dried them once, which helps set the emulsion, you pull out big trays of dye. Like I said, magenta, yellow, and cyan dyes. And they're what's known as acid-fixing dyes. And acid-fixing dyes have an interesting property, which is gelatin will absorb them, but only so much. If you have a cubic cc of gelatin, it will absorb so many milligrams of dye, and no more. And that's what makes the process controllable, because you've got these sheet film plates, the matrices, which have a certain thickness of gelatin on them. You put them in a dye bath of certain acidity, and you know that that gelatin will absorb only a certain amount of dye, no more and no less. If it weren't for that, it would never be reproducible. And that's where the control comes in, being able to control how much dye it picks up. Anyway, you soak each of these matrices in a tray of its complementary color of dye, and then you rinse it off in a 1% acetic acid rinse. There's lots of 1% acetic acid that's used in the dye transfer process. In fact, prints come off smelling a little bit like vinegar. When I send someone a print that they've bought, I include a note that explains that when they open the package, they're going to get a slight whiff of vinegar. And the prints will smell like that for anywhere from weeks to years, and it's normal. It's kind of the hallmark of a relatively fresh dye transfer print, is that you think you're in a salad bar.
Is this a problem with the prints outgassing that I shouldn't put it underneath glass? Or is it not outgassing, it just smells and that's the way it is?
It's just a little bit of acetic acid that's retained by the paper. And acetic acid is benign, harmless stuff. Unlike sulfuric or nitric acid, it will not break down the cellulose in the paper, it will not damage the dye, it will not do anything else. In fact, it's necessary to the stability of the print. As I said, these are acid-fixing dyes, and the print should be in a neutral to slightly acidic state to preserve it. When you're framing and matting dye transfer prints, you never ever use buffered board. You don't want to use alkalide buffered board like you would with a black and white print. Actually, that's true of all color prints, now that I think about it. Most color dyes don't like having pH messed with. And just a little tip, if you're matting and framing color prints, traditional color prints, make sure that you get unbuffered board, museum-quality unbuffered board. Most of the big supply companies that sell museum goods will sell that. And if the board doesn't say unbuffered, it isn't. The norm is now for products to be buffered. So if it doesn't say whether it's buffered or not, assume it is buffered. If it is not buffered, it will say unbuffered. So the dye transfer prints have all this acetic acid going around. You soak the matrices in them, you rinse off the excess dye with acetic acid. It just soaks into the paper. And so they end up smelling a little bit of vinegar. It's something you get used to. Fortunately, it's not a bad smell. 1% acetic is very dilute. Normal household vinegar is 5%. So this is not like when you open a bottle of glacial acetic acid and you get overwhelmed by the acrid fumes. This is very, very mild stuff. Like I said, it's like living in a salad bar. So, you've got these matrices, you've soaked them in the trays of dye, you've rinsed off the excess dye so that the only dye in the matrix is what's held in the gelatin. Now you take a sheet of what's called dye transfer paper. Dye transfer paper starts out as ordinary black and white photographic paper. It's exactly the same base, a Barrett overcoat, a gelatin layer on top of that. The difference between dye transfer paper and regular photographic paper is that dye transfer paper has no light-sensitive compounds in it. There are no silver salts, no nothing else. What it does have is a chemical called a mordant, which is a chemical that locks onto dye molecules. Mordants are very common. You use them all the time with dyes. If you ever dyed any fabric with Rit dye and they told you to dump this package of salts in the water, those were mordants. Those were something that would make sure that the dye molecules locked into the fabric. Well, dye transfer paper uses a mordant also, and it's one of the reasons that nobody makes dye transfer paper anymore, because the mordant is thorium nitrate. It's not terribly radioactive, but it is very, very, very slightly radioactive. And how many photographic manufacturers really want to work with radioisotopes in their factory?
Not many.
You got it. Kodak, in fact, had an old coating machine for this. It dated from, I was going to say turn of the century, but I should rephrase that, turn of the last century. It was a coating machine they used for coating the dye transfer paper. They didn't use it for anything else. It was old enough that even though it was made out of cast iron, it had wooden drive gears. It was that old. And they used it for dye transfer paper because when they stopped making dye transfer paper, they were going to scrap that machine. They weren't even going to try and clean it up. So thorium nitrate is the mordant in dye transfer paper, and that was a Kodak trade secret for years until they stopped making the materials. It's what makes the paper special, and it's why most people can't simply make good dye transfer paper themselves. In theory, you could take regular photographic paper, fix out the silver salts, and then mordant the paper yourself. But who wants to go to the trouble of getting a hazmat license these days?
No.
Yeah. Anyway, you take your dye transfer paper. You take a sheet of that, which you've soaked in a conditioning solution that wets it down, and you squeegee it down flat onto a transfer board. It could be metal, it could be glass, it could be granite, something that's big and flat. The transfer board has little register pins stuck in the end of it. They're the same pins that were in the exposure easel under the enlarger, and they're the same pins that match the holes in the matrices. You're seeing where this goes. So you take the matrix. You press the holes in the matrix over the pins in the register board. Now you've lined up the matrix. You take a roller squeegee and you squeegee that matrix down onto the sheet of dye transfer paper, emulsion to emulsion, and the dye transfers from the matrix to the paper. And that's where the name comes from. Ta-da! That is the dye transfer step. After 5 or 10 minutes, you peel away the matrix, and the dye that was formerly in the matrix is now in the print. Usually in this case, you've got a magenta or a cyan image, nothing else. You can take that matrix now and put it in hot water to rinse off the chemicals and either hang it up to dry or put it back in the dye bath to make another print. Now you take your second matrix, same thing. Press it down over the register pins, squeegee it down onto the sheet of paper, wait another appropriate length of time, peel it off, and the second color is transferred. And because you did everything with those register pins, the colors line up if you're careful. If you're not careful, they don't. Again, that's part of the craft of learning how to do the rolling so that you don't distort anything. Do that for all three colors, cyan, magenta, and yellow, and you have a full color print that you just dry normally. It's a fiber-based air-dried F surface. Looks just like a traditional darkroom print.
Now, once you transfer the three matrices over, do you need to fix this other receiver piece, the print itself? Do you have to do any other thing to it, or basically rinse it, or is it just, it's done, that's it?
It's done. At this point, all you need to do is dry it. The mordant in the paper has locked down the dyes. The print is now as stable and permanent as it will ever be, and that's extremely stable. In fact, generally, you don't want to mess with it further. Of course, there's always spotting and retouching that needs to be done. But after I've done all the spotting and retouching, I actually take the print and soak it in a big tray of 1% acetic acid again, just to make sure that any chemicals I may have used in the spotting and the retouching are all washed out. And then I dry it a second time.
Now, when you're going through and doing your spotting and touching up here with, of course, using, I'm assuming, one of the three dyes that you need to touch up or a combination of all three together, does this stuff blend in very well where you can't really notice on the F surface of the paper that it's been touched up?
Perfectly. And that's one of the big reasons that dye transfer was important in the advertising business. The mainstay of dye transfer for decades was the advertising business. It's also where people got the notion that dye transfer was only for printing slides. You can tell from the description I've given that it's actually a negative to positive process. More light produces a darker picture. But the advertising business used chromes, and dye transfers were done for the advertising business. So there were methods for making separations from slides that you could use with the dye transfer process. And people just assumed that it was inherently a positive to positive process. And most of them are surprised when they find out, no, it's actually a negative to positive process. It's just hardly anyone did it that way, except for fine art photographers like me who were fixated on negatives in the first place. But the spotting is indeed done with the dye transfer dyes, and they soak into the emulsion and are mordanted down just the same way the dyes are from the matrix. So the spotting is indetectable, and it will also be just as stable as the original print, and it will even fade under prolonged exposure to light at the same rate.
Wow.
And it has exactly the same optical characteristics. So this is why it was great for advertising. You did retouching in advertising photographs and dye transfers, and it was perfect. When you sent it out to the printing shop to be separated for the magazine, it would always separate perfectly. There was no way to tell. When you use normal spotting dyes on normal prints, if they're not the same kind of dye or pigment, they look different. Or at least they'll look different to the copy camera.
And they'd put it in a stat camera to make these printing press separations, and it would look different. Boom,
exactly.
You would show up right away.
Exactly. On a dye transfer print, the corrections, the retouching, and the spotting are indistinguishable from the rest of the print. In every single respect, there's no change in surface finish, there's no change in permanence, there's no change in color. Unfortunately, of course, it takes a lot of time to do that. If you think about it, these big wet sheets of film, if a piece of dust gets between the matrix and the paper, well, that leaves a little space where the dye didn't transfer. As I mentioned earlier, if there's any dust on the original negative or slide or separations, that makes a little spot in the matrix. If you accidentally scratch the matrix or get a piece of grit on it or do something else to bang it up, that also mars the matrix. Really, really clean matrices are very unusual. I have never, ever made a dye transfer print that didn't require some spotting. Not once, not ever, not in my whole career, and I've printed, I don't know, somewhere between 500 and 1,000 original dye transfers, and not one of them ever came out where it didn't need some spotting. Sometimes it was very little. Sometimes it was only 5 minutes. Other times it would be an entire day, and I hate those. But it happens.
Exactly.
But it's never, ever, ever perfect.
Let's talk about what the print looks like in comparison. So back when they started actually doing the dye transfer process, of course, if you wanted to print from a piece of chrome, you would do a Cibachrome. They had the dye transfer, then they had traditional color processing. What drew you the most into the dye transfer process? Is it the way the print looks? It's hard to explain over a radio piece, over audio, on how a print looks, but maybe you can explain.
I can do it.
Maybe you can explain to us the difference between, okay, well, I have a regular C print, an RA4, a Cibachrome, and a dye transfer. Maybe you can sort of...
I think I can do it more simply than that. There's two ways in which the prints look superior, and they're both important. The first way is inherent in the materials. A dye transfer print has a longer density range than any other known printing process, period. Any kind, anywhere in the world, ever. A conventional color print and an Ilfachrome print, they'll have maximum density of somewhere in the range of about 2.4, give or take a little. Putting that in English terms, that's a brightness range of 300 to 1. A black and white print, really well made, well toned, etc., etc., similar kind of range, maybe 2.4. Depending on the paper finish, you'll actually see anything between 2.1 and 2.4, and if you like matte papers, it gets a lot worse. But that's as high as you get. Density range in a dye transfer, depending on the original and how you want it to look and the contrast you're going for and all of those aesthetic factors, is somewhere between 2.6 and 3.0.
Wow.
In other words, you're getting 1 to 2 stops more density range in a dye transfer print than you can in any other kind of print. It's like having high-fidelity speakers on your sound system and a really, really good amp. The music sounds good on an ordinary one. You put it on a really good system with really good dynamic range, and you start to hear nuances you never heard before. And the brilliance gets better, and because the dynamic range is longer, subtleties get separated better. And that's the inherent advantage dye transfer has. The other thing dye transfer has going for it is a very clean dye set in terms of color quality. Chromogenic prints have this horrible yellow. It's very orange in color. You know, we jokingly call it Kodak yellow because it's about the color of a Kodak box. It's not a nice, true, pure process yellow. It's a yellow with a lot of magenta in it. The dye transfer yellow is absolutely beautifully, perfectly yellow. If you need to make a print of a sunflower, dye transfer is the way to do it. It has secondary effects also. Having a really clean yellow means you also get much more brilliant greens because they don't have the magenta contamination in them, and you get separation of reds and oranges into subtle color differences that would be simply lost in a chromogenic print. I have an early photo. I did one of my first dye transfers. Is a photograph of a sunrise behind the Apollo 17 moon rocket. And the picture is mostly in golds. When I print it as a chromogenic print, it all looks a uniform gold color. If I print it as a dye transfer, you see there are subtle variations of yellows, oranges, and browns throughout the clouds and the shadows. Those are simply masked by the chromogenic yellow. So better color purity and a massively better density range are what give dye transfer inherent advantages over any other printing process, and it's one of the reasons I keep doing dye transfer, because I have a certain number of photographs that I can't print any other way and have them look right. One of the bad problems of doing dye transfer for 30 years now is that I've adjusted my photography for dye transfer. I started making photographs that I knew couldn't be printed any other way, so I'm kind of stuck with it. That's the one advantage of dye transfer. The second advantage, which doesn't mean as much in this digital age, is the degree of control you get. In normal Ilfachrome or chromogenic printing, you don't have a lot of control during printing. You can slightly vary the contrast, or you can do masking to massively vary the contrast. And that's pretty much it, unless you get into some very, very, very exotic techniques. In dye transfer, I can vary the contrast of each of the colors individually when I expose and process the matrices. I can vary the contrast of each of the colors individually when I soak them in the dyes by using different acidity in the dyes and different rinses. I can add density to shadows without affecting highlights. I can remove density from highlights without affecting midtones or shadows. I can remove density overall from one or more colors as I wish. I can do all of these things independently of each other. Think of the level of control you have over how the print looks when you can actually control the contrast of the color overall, the density of the color overall, the color balance, and then you can individually tweak each of the colors. For instance, if you have a print where the highlights are a bit off in color and the rest of the print looks fine, I can fix that in dye transfer. If I have a print where the print overall looks good but the highlights are a little flat, I can kick up the highlights a little with the rinses. If I have a print that needs just a bit more boost in the shadows but looks good otherwise, I can do that in dye transfer. Nowadays, we can do all of that in Photoshop.
But you're not going to get a D-Max out of any inkjet printer that's going to hit 3.
No, exactly.
No way.
And that's why I'm still doing both. So, to construct a kind of reverse neologism, dye transfer is like Photoshop in the darkroom.
Well, exactly, because you have control over all this process.
You have control over all of the stuff that you don't have with any other modern color printing process. And it's the combination of both the control and the inherent quality of the medium that is what makes dye transfer prints so superior in many respects. Now, I'm going to qualify that, which is, dye transfer is good. Photoshop is better. I can do things to curve shapes in Photoshop that I can't do in dye transfer. I can make adjustments in Photoshop with a precision that I can't do in dye transfer. I can adjust highlight and subtle tonal rendition in Photoshop in a way that is simply impossible in the darkroom. So, control counts. And the result is that some of my photographs look better as digital prints than they do as dye transfers. When I started getting seriously into digital printing, I did some portfolios that are up on my website, monograph volumes, which were assemblages of very carefully made digital prints. The first one I decided to do was a portfolio of Scotland that I had already done in dye transfer, 28 photographs of the Highlands. And I had already done that as a dye transfer portfolio. I decided to try and turn that into a book printed digitally by myself. And my objective there was to try and match the dye transfer prints as closely as I could, allowing for the fact it's a different medium. I understand that. But I wanted to get the same aesthetic impact in the digital prints that I did in the dye transfers. To my surprise, I found that about half the time, I liked them equally well. They were different, but I thought the digital prints were just as good, for some artistic meaning of the word good, as the dye transfer prints. They were different, but they satisfied me just as much. About 35-40% of the time, the digital prints were clearly inferior. There were ways in which the dye transfer print just worked better. The extra dynamic range, the kind of controls I had in the darkroom, a combination of factors, but it just came out superior. In 10 to 15% of the cases, the digital print was clearly superior. Those were the photographs where having the extra degree of control on the computer trumped the quality of the medium. This is an important lesson for photographers. It's not just about the tools, it's about the techniques. And that applies, of course, across the board, whether you're using film, whether you're using digital cameras, whether you're printing in a darkroom, whether you're printing digitally. It isn't about the tools, it's what you can do with the tools.
Right, because really I think in the end it's all about the print.
It is all about the print. It is all about the art. I'm considered to be, as I said, a supreme technical geek and know all this stuff backwards and forwards. And I don't know all of it, I just know a lot of it. But I don't actually care about the technique. The technique has always been a way for me to get to the print I wanted to make. I am not interested in technique for the sake of technique, not unless someone's paying me to write a review or an article on it. Honestly, one of the reasons I know so much technique is because people would pay me to research that stuff.
Right.
But for me, it's entirely about the art. The technique is always in the service of the art. And if learning a new technique lets me produce a better print, well, I'm willing to learn that technique. And if I don't think it'll produce me a better print, I don't care. And honestly, I don't think anyone else should either, unless they're solely interested in photography as a craft, which is cool. That's fine. That's fun. It's a neat hobby. But don't confuse the craft with making photographs that you really like.
No, because like you said, it's all in return. You know, when you did the capture, either it be analog or digital, no matter how you capture said image, it's all about the print, because the print is something you can sell, something you can hang on the wall, something that you can give away, and it's your artistic vision of what you saw at the time and what you think it should be in the end.
Mm-hmm. Heck, something you can just love and admire for your own choice. The art has to make you happy. It's also nice if it can make you a living, but if it doesn't make you happy, it isn't where you want it to be.
No.
And this is the thing, this is the lesson I have the most trouble explaining to people, is that in that sense, I'm not a gearhead. I just know way too much of that stuff, and I'm good at it. But it's not what drives me. As you could tell from this whole conversation, I moved into color negative, I moved into medium format, I moved into dye transfer. Every step along the way, that move was driven by the fact that I wanted to get a better print, that I wasn't getting the prints I wanted. It wasn't because I was thrilled with the idea of learning a new technique. It was because it was serving my art.
So you must be thrilled now to see the evolution of the digital print and what's going on now. I mean, there's a lot of people that make inkjet products, but I think leading the way in quality is the new Epson stuff with their HDR ink sets and the Epson 7900. And what you can achieve with these digital prints now got to be close to rivaling what you can do on dye transfer, except you don't have a 3.0 D-Max, no matter what. It doesn't matter what paper you got or what ink set, they still can't hit 3.
Right, but a lot of time you don't need 3.0. A lot of time you don't even need 2.6. It's nice if you've got it, but it isn't even necessary a lot of the time. And I would point out there's no inherent reason it can't get there. I'm not saying it will. That's essentially a market-driven decision. You might consider it analogous to the one of, well, if dye transfer existed, why didn't all photographic prints look as good as dye transfers? And the answer is because 99.9% of the world was entirely happy with the quality of chromogenic prints. They didn't need dye transfer. There's nothing technically to keep someone from making a digital printer that makes prints with the quality of a dye transfer print, except there may not be sufficient demand for it. But technically, it's not a difficulty. If you think about the process I've described, it's very primitive. It's dyes put on paper. There's no fancy chemical tricks involved. There's no exotic color couplers or specially designed silver grains involved. It's just dye moved onto paper. In fact, just for the heck of it, about a dozen years ago, I took an old inkjet printer of mine and replaced the inks in the cartridge with dye transfer inks. It worked.
It worked.
Yes, the prints were lousy because nothing was calibrated for that.
Right.
The ink flow wasn't right, the drying times weren't right, the paper motion wasn't right, the printer wasn't really designed to handle paper like that, especially after it got wet. I'm saying there were all sorts of engineering problems.
You can make this work, though. I mean, if you really wanted to, you could hack apart some Epson or HP printer and make this work.
I've always told people, give me $100,000 and I'll make a digital dye transfer printer. Nobody's felt like giving me $100,000 yet, but it would be entirely doable. The point here is not that you should actually do that. It's that there is nothing that technically stands in the way of getting to the point where digital printers can produce prints that are physically as good as dye transfer prints. Absolutely nothing. Whether we will get there will turn out to be a market and demand issue. But already, digital printers are marvelous. And like I said, I've been watching these now develop for 35 years. And it's been a long, slow development process. And I've varied between being a cheerleader and a naysayer. Back in the 80s, I was a cheerleader. That was when people didn't even believe digital photography was possible in any good way. And I kept saying, no, I was doing stuff 10 years ago. I know how to design the cameras. I know how to make the printers. They'll cost you millions of dollars right now, but it's doable. Then in the mid-90s, I had to become a naysayer, because people had started to click into what digital could do, and they were all convinced that the revolution was around the corner, and that film was going to disappear, and cameras were going to disappear, and it was all going to happen by next Christmas. I was talking to a high-level representative from one of the film companies, in fact, in 1995. I won't say which representative, which company. And they asked me, should I buy a digital camera right now? Because it looks to me like film is just going away. And I said, no. Yes, digital is the wave of the future, but the wave is made out of molasses, and this is January. Yes, we finally hit the point where the turnover is occurring, where digital is coming to dominate. But as someone who's been doing it for over 3 decades, I know how long a process this is and how evolutionary it is. It only looks like a revolution when the wave breaks, but the wave takes a long time to get there. And there will continue to be steady improvements. I would note that there continue to be steady improvements in film as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, definitely there's some new emulsions that have just been released by multiple manufacturers that are pretty amazing stuff.
Mm-hmm. We've got Ektar 100 for color negative fans. I know that there are tricks in the labs, which may or may not ever see the light of day for market reasons, but we're not short of being able to see improvements in film emulsions. I bring that up as a sign of the actual health of the industry. The fact is, films today are fabulously good. I think we would all be perfectly happy if films never got one bit better. We could live with that. They've improved so much in the last 20 years. But as long as manufacturers are still willing to roll out new film products, you can't say the film business is dead. Some point in the future, I don't know. And I certainly won't guarantee any particular product. I don't think you will be buying the same films in 20 years that you're buying now. And I'm pretty certain you won't be buying them from the same manufacturers, possibly. But you'll still be able to get film. You'll still be able to get print paper. And there's nothing new about that. Go back and read all the old journals of large, famous view camera photographers. read about what happened when DuPont went out of business in, what was it, the 1950s, when they got out of the film business, and all these people were stocking DuPont photographic papers because they had just loved them and they were the perfect paper and film that they wanted to be using. There's nothing new to this. The problem with working in a technology-based art form is that you're at the mercy of the technologists and the companies making the technology, and that hasn't changed.
No, because it's all about the bottom line, and if they can't sell it and make money, then they're not going to do it, good, bad, or indifferent.
Pretty much that's true often enough. Sometimes you get reprieves. Kodak kept eye transfer going the same way it kept Kodachrome going for many more years than it should have by a pure bottom line basis because the materials were their flagship materials. They were done for the prestige. You still see that going on today. In case your listeners don't know this, medium format's dead. I hate to tell you that. Medium format died around the turn of the century. It was killed by digital. I know that's a shock, but I got this directly from the horse's mouth, which was from the chief AGFA representative in this area. And we had a dinner. I can say that now because AGFA's gone and he's gone.
Right.
But we had a dinner conversation about all of this, and he told me in confidence in the early 2000s, he said, nope, medium format's dead. And I said to him, okay, well, why do you keep coming out with new medium format films, and why do they keep introducing new medium format cameras? And he said, it's the prestige factor. It's the same reason Canon and Nikon and Leica produce a certain number of lenses which nobody could possibly afford and nobody will ever use, but because it's about image. It establishes you as being a quality player. But digital killed medium format, because it transformed the wedding business, which was already getting changed by 35 millimeter, and it transformed the portrait business. The workflows for digital are perfectly suited to weddings and portraiture. And where do you think 99% of medium format money came from?
Wedding.
And portraiture.
Yeah. The only problem today with digital in the wedding environment is photographers that are shooting wedding stuff now have not traditionally been trained. The entry point to a digital rig now is a $1,500 kit camera and lens, and they take so many pictures that they've turned into this post-processing nightmare that when you get back from a wedding, now you have 4,000 images to process and pick through, because instead of trying to do, like you said, when you learn the traditional photographic process, or you've done extremely on a really tight budget when you have to pay for your own film, or if you're shooting 4x5, you learn how to compose and expose and do these traditional processes to make a great image, to make a great photograph. And the people doing digital that I've seen a lot of personally is, it's just like, it's almost like a video camera. Just turn it on, burn, and just let it roll, baby.
I don't agree with you. I really don't agree with you on this. First, my style isn't the right way to do it. It's just my style. I've done a certain amount of photography with my best friend and sometimes photography partner, Laurie Toby Edison. We've done some collaboration work together that's on the website. We have very, very different working styles. She uses a camera like a sketch pad. That's the best way I can describe it. I will go out and find a scene, and I'll look at it for a long, 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 long time. And then I'll probably make one exposure, and then I'll pack up the tripod and say, okay, I'm done. I don't even bracket. I just know at this point. Laurie will work around. She'll photograph it from different angles. She'll photograph it from different points of view. She'll move around. She'll play with it. It's the way an artist would work with a sketch pad, where I'll make one photograph, she'll make 35 or 40. My results aren't any better than hers. And if I tried to work her way, I'd go crazy. I would get lost, as you said, in the whole myriad of similar but slightly different photographs, and I would lose my focus. If she tried to work my way, she'd never ever refine what she was doing. It would not become concrete in her head. For her, making the photographs is a process of taking notes. And I, honest to God, don't think there is a right way or a wrong way to do it. All that counts is the art you get in the end.
This is true. Like you said, it's all about the print. So
this is all philosophy, and we could argue about this forever, and it doesn't mean I'm right and you're wrong.
Right.
Artistic philosophy is not something you can settle over the phone.
So true. I just see that the extra expense and the work that people go through to capture so many thousands of images at an event that's like a wedding photographer person would be just so much work, they don't have any life left. They're just engulfed in Photoshop or some other type of digital acquisition software.
I feel the same way personally. I can't imagine working that way. I'm appalled at the number of photographs I make with my digital camera, and it's minuscule compared to most other people. It's just several times more than I ever would have made with a film camera.
Right.
But on the other hand, I suspect if you went and talked to those people and told them how many hours I spend trying to get a single print right, they would have the same reaction, which is, God, doesn't he have a life?
The process of dye transfer, it's completely done. You can't get any chemicals, no more film. Nobody can get into this anymore. And how much is left for you to continue to keep printing and doing your craft?
The future. Well, let me give a bit of background, which was dye transfer was a process that was exclusive to Kodak. They were the only people who produced the materials, and the market was not big enough in its last several decades to justify anyone else getting into it. Fuji tested the waters a little bit and decided not to go there. So dye transfer was exclusive to them, the same way Ilfachrome was exclusive to Ilford. Kodak decided in 1993 that they were going to get rid of dye transfer. So they secretly killed it. I'm not joking. They did it in secret because they knew there would be an outcry if they told people they were going to do this. But they decided to get rid of it. Their prerogative. They weren't particularly nice about it, and they actually weren't even entirely legal about it. But what you're going to do? That's water under the bridge. That's 15 years ago. So for 15 years, there's been no major manufacturer of dye transfer materials. Nonetheless, there are a couple of dozen of us around the world who are still doing dye transfer printing, and there are four of us, including me, who actually do it for other people. You know, we have a small custom lab business going. That's possible because a lot of us stockpiled materials. When Kodak said, we're getting out of the business, we scrounged every bit we could. I took out a second mortgage and bought a deep freeze. No joke. It still got my Pan Matrix film in it. I bought as much paper and dyes as I could. Other people did the same thing. We're still printing, amazingly enough. I was certain it would be dead by now. I confidently predicted it would be dead by now back when Kodak did this. I said, well, we'll still be doing dye transfer another 10, 12 years. 15 years from now, it'll all be gone. Well, it's 15 years later, and it isn't all gone. Turns out there's an awful lot of stuff that's in the woodworks. Every so often, I'll get an email from somebody saying, I was going and cleaning out my darkroom, and I found this, that, or the other. Can you or somebody use it? And the answer
always is,
oh boy, can we. And a lot of the times, it's things like dyes and paper, which are shelf-stable. They don't have to be refrigerated. They'll last forever. Sometimes it's matrix film, which definitely has to be kept frozen. But you'd be amazed how many people did that. They stuck it in the back of their refrigerator or their deep freeze, and they only just discovered it now, a dozen years later. So stuff comes out of the woodworks. It's astonishing. I'm just in the midst of doing a horrendously large printing job. I did a print offer with Mike Johnston through the online photographer, and we decided to offer people small dye transfer prints very, very inexpensively. Chose ones that I could print quite easily. Apropos the earlier conversation about how long it takes to make and spot prints, I chose ones here that would go really fast. I got flooded with orders. We got totally swamped. I'm going to be in the darkroom solid for the next 4 months printing. I thought it was going to use up two-thirds of my remaining dye transfer supplies. Out of nowhere, simply nowhere, two people contacted me and said, I've got this dye transfer paper. Do you want it? They hadn't heard about the print offer. I hadn't solicited them. It just fell into my lap. I'm going to end up with more paper than I started with.
Wow.
Apparently the gods want me to continue doing dye transfer. I was looking forward to saying I'm done with that part of my career.
It won't die.
Nope, they're saying it will not die. Same thing happens to other people's. Plus, there is a small cottage industry making materials. As I described earlier, the paper is not technically complicated. It just involves some noxious chemicals. Well, there are people out there who are willing to play with those noxious chemicals, and they're making the stuff for themselves. There are lots of people working on dye formulations for themselves. Jim Browning in Vermont even had a run of matrix film done according to his specifications by FK in Europe. So, stuff turns up. Stuff still happens. I think what's going to happen is that, much like tricolor pigment printing, carbocarbon printing, dye transfer is actually a primitive enough process that it will continue to exist as a cottage industry indefinitely. I don't know how long there'll be commercial people doing it. We went from 5 people doing it commercially this year down to 4. One of them finally retired. There are still 4 of us in the world printing commercially. There are still a couple dozen of us printing for ourselves. But I think the ones who are printing for ourselves may last a very, very long time. I think it may never die, at least until digital printers get so fabulously good that everyone has forgotten. I think it may end up in the same vein as pigment printing, as platinum printing. All these old processes that were primitive enough, and I use that word advisedly, that an individual could manufacture them themselves if they really wanted to. No individual can manufacture a modern integral tri-pack color emulsion. You can't do it.
No.
It requires a level of technology you just don't have. But this old stuff is crude. This old stuff, you know, is nails and hammers and anvils and forges. This is stuff that individuals can do, and there are a handful of people out there who are crazy enough to do it. I'm not one of them. I'm still working off of stockpiled Kodak supplies, and when those are gone, I am done. It will take too much of my life to try and make my own materials. I don't think I'm going to be the last dye transfer printer, to my surprise. I really don't.
Now, let's talk about if someone wants you to make a print for them.
Mm-hmm.
I need to supply you with a negative, a digital file, and what's it cost to have, let's say, let's just pick an 8x10 as a round number.
Well, I can work from anything. I can work from a negative, I can work from a slide, I can work from a digital file. For that matter, so can Jim Browning in Vermont. I don't know what other people can do, but I can work from any kind of an original. Personally, I prefer negatives because it's what I do all the time for myself, but it turns out most of my clients end up having slides.
Right.
It's not cheap, and it's not fast. The big thing is, with all the time it takes to make a print and run tests, the first thing I ask a client really is, A, what can you afford, and B, what kind of timetable are you on? I've had people come to me and ask me for quotes on portfolios, things like 20 originals, 25 sets. And I come back to them and say, do you have any idea how long that's going to take or what it's going to cost you? And they might have an idea of the cost, but they've never thought about how long it will take. You know, imagine making 500 large dye transfer prints, including the test prints and the back and forth in the mails to get them approved by the client and so on and so forth. You're not talking about something that gets done next week. You're not talking about something that even gets done in 1 year. It's a long-term process. I generally tell people, figure it's going to be about a month to get your first dye transfer, because I'm going to have to get your original, I'm going to have to talk with you about what you want done, I'm going to have to make a test print, you're going to have to look at the test print and tell me everything that's wrong with it, then I'm going to go back and print it again, and hopefully the second time will be right, but maybe we'll have to do it a third time. In other words, it's a lot like working with a custom lab. Funny thing. So I generally tell people a month for the first one. If you've got a whole bunch of stuff to do, we can pipeline it. I can be working on later prints while you're approving earlier ones. But it isn't going to be fast. Cost is the second thing. These days, I charge people about $1,500 for the first dye transfer print. Period. Doesn't matter what size print, doesn't matter what kind of original. Additional prints are a lot cheaper. The wonderful thing is that once I've made those matrices and figured out the exact rinses that I need to print them correctly, that's all pretty reproducible. So I'll still have all the time to actually roll a print in the darkroom and the incredibly tedious spotting and retouching time, but I don't have to start from scratch again. So my rule of thumb is that additional prints ordered at any time are about a third the cost of the first print.
So something would be applicable to having a portfolio done if I had 10, 20, 30 pictures and I wanted to actually put the time and have a limited edition dye transfer set made of a portfolio, something you could do.
It's something I could do. It's something Jim could do or Guy could do in Washington or Andy could do in Australia. Those are the four of us. San Francisco Bay Area, Vermont, Washington State, and Australia. That's the world's supply of commercial dye transfer printers at this point. Go Aussies. They got one.
Right.
Anyway, and we all know each other, by the way. Everybody in this business knows each other and is friends. It's a very small business, and dye transfer is such a dauntingly complex process that if we weren't all friends and compared notes and exchanged helpful tips, we just wouldn't be able to do it. Nobody's ever mastered this. We all learn from each other. Anyway, so yeah, if you wanted something like that, there are several of us who could do it, assuming we could fit it into our schedule. This is always one of the problems, and it would be time-consuming. At this point, like I said, my darkroom time is totally locked up for the next 4 months. After that, you know, I might be able to talk to somebody. You know, run the numbers. Imagine you wanted, say, a portfolio of 10 photographs, and you wanted 20 copies of it. Well, assuming they're 16 by 20 prints, we're talking $1,500 for the first print times 10. And then we're talking $500 for each additional print times 180.
Right. It'd be a good gig for you.
It would be a good gig for me.
Yeah.
I get asked to quote on those once or twice a year, actually. I won't tell you what percentage of them actually happen. Actually, I will tell you. It's approximately zero. Almost all my printing is done for clients who want one or two images printed. They may want them done on an ongoing business as they sell stuff through galleries. But nobody who has ever come to me and said, I want a portfolio of X prints and an edition of Y, has followed through on it. I'm happy to keep quoting. One of these days, it might happen. It might even happen before I run out of supplies.
Well, if somebody has the images that they've acquired, either the traditional analog process, digital, or however they want to do it, and it has such a dynamic range and a latitude that they want printed in color that they cannot achieve in another way, they have no other option.
They really have no other option, but they then might decide to simply bide their time and wait.
You could.
I should also say there's always the subjective factor, which is I have to like the work. Otherwise, I'm not interested in doing it. But truthfully, that has not been an issue so far. Anybody who's coming to me to ask me about having dye transfer printing done is doing good enough photography that I like the work. But it's always a criterion. I always reserve the right to look at this and say to myself, this is boring. I'm not going to do this. Waiting makes sense. I have a photograph. In 1991, I drove down to the tip of Baja to photograph the solar eclipse there. My objective then was to make the best possible print of a total eclipse that I knew how to make. I knew I could capture the information on the film with sufficient care. I really didn't know how to print it. And dye transfer was the way I went first, and it was the toughest dye transfer print I ever made, and it still is. And in a sense, I really hate selling copies of it because it's so much work to do. This is a print that doesn't require 3 transfers. It requires 9 to get everything right.
Wow.
It's terrifying. But it was the absolute best analog photograph of an eclipse that I knew how to make, and it was one of the best I'd ever seen. Then digital came along, which I knew it would eventually. Remember, I'd been doing this for a long time. And eventually it got good enough where I said, I can go back and work on that photograph again. And that's been my project this winter, is to go back and do it even better digitally. So, you know, the person who wants that dye transfer portfolio done and truly can't afford $50,000 to $100,000, well, unless there's a clock ticking, wait and see. Digital might get there. They might also go talk to someone who's a really good custom digital printer. I do that also. And have a test image done to see what they can get digitally. Just as with analog custom labs, there's a huge difference in the quality of custom printers digitally. And just because you didn't get a good print out of one lab doesn't mean you won't get a good one out of someone else.
So true.
And that's always been true in the custom business. Some of the dye transfer business I got was from people who tried to get prints done by other labs and couldn't get them to look exactly the way they wanted. Conversely, there's at least one job that I couldn't do for somebody because I couldn't make prints exactly the way she wanted. That's part of the life. It's part of finding a good arrangement with a custom printer, is you're not always artistically compatible.
Now, from what you've seen, do you have found that you're going to get a better C print from an optical enlargement or from a analog capture, digital scan, and output, let's say, to like some kind of digital printer, like a Durst or some other type of C process that's been digitally written to the paper?
Oh, no question. Digital's better. Digital's absolutely better. And it's better for 2 reasons I can explain pretty simply. The first is that you can reshape that characteristic curve to be a perfect match for the tonal placement you want in the print paper. You know, zone system on steroids, but it's applied to color. Whereas in the dark room with conventional enlargement, you've got the characteristic curve of the film, you've got the characteristic curve of the paper, and you're just plain stuck. That's reason number one. The second reason is that those color deficiencies that I mentioned in the chromogenic dyes, you can correct a lot of that digitally. It's called undercutting, is the technical term for it. And you can remove a lot of the color deficiencies from chromogenic materials by proper processing of the digital information. You can't make it perfect, but you can get it much, much closer. So the result is that digital print made on chromogenic materials, if it's done right, is always going to blow away a darkroom print made on chromogenic materials because you get to use tools that you just don't have in the darkroom.
Right, because I can adjust my color levels to match the curves of the paper so I can get everything I can out of said material.
Right. And that whole problem with the magenta color contamination in yellow, well, as long as it isn't a pure process yellow that you're going for, as long as it's a tone in the paper which would have some magenta in it anyway, well, you can subtract that amount of magenta out. You can't go negative. You can't go below zero magenta. But you can compensate to the degree that you can remove magenta dye. That's the undercutting part. So digital prints on chromogenic paper can't produce a perfect sunflower yellow, but they'll produce much, much better oranges and much, much better greens.
The only way to get the perfect sunflower is to have you print it for them.
or to print it purely digitally.
Right. You can get really good stuff. And I think that's what's great about photography right now in general is you can still capture on film. You can still be involved with a tactile experience and develop your own film and do some fun stuff. But you can also then scan the stuff and then use these new technologies to even exceed your vision than you could have in the darkroom. So I think the whole hybrid process is really cool.
I think it's just wonderful. I consider what I said about doing that Scotland portfolio. Half the stuff I thought was as good as dye transfer, and 10% of it I thought was better. And this is stuff that anybody could do with sufficient skill. I'm talking artistic skill here. But they could do it in their office on their computer with Photoshop and a not hugely expensive printer. It would take them years and years to master the artistic techniques, but they wouldn't have to set up a darkroom to do dye transfer. They could do it in the comfort of their own office. They don't have to learn the whole manual craft and deal with all the nasty, smelly stuff. Honest to God, I think it's a godsend. I think it's wonderful.
It is fun stuff, but I still think it's cool, too, that if someone still wants to go into the dark room, they can still do something that's a tactile experience and work with your hands. So I think it's great to see that the option's there that lets pretty much anybody do whatever you want to do still.
If you aren't yet doing dye transfer printing and you're interested in doing it, you need to get a supply of materials first. I get several inquiries a year from people who want to learn dye transfer printing. It's not that hard to learn. You can tell from my description of it that while it may be meticulous, it's not complicated. I can teach someone the mechanics of dye transfer printing in a single weekend. The problem is, what are they going to print with? Where are they going to get the film? Where are they going to get the dyes? Where are they going to get the paper? So I just wanted to introduce that caution ahead of time, is that before someone listening to this gets all excited about doing their own dye transfer prints, you need to line up a source of supplies. The other thing is, if you're interested in dye transfer just in general, Jim Browning maintains a dye transfer email mailing list. And I'm sure you've got the email address and URL for that floating around somewhere, so I will not recite it here.
They can find it on the web or just go to APUG or other places and grab this information.
Yes. Some of the people who hang out in APUG also hung out on the dye transfer mailing list. So if you post a query there, they'll happily tell you. And there's lots of people there who will happily talk about dye transfer with you and help you out with techniques and things like that. But as I said, the real thing is, if you're interested in doing this, you need to figure out how you're going to get your supplies. And you can find people who've got supplies they don't need. You can find people who even have defective materials that they'll let you play with, to learn with. But do understand that hardly anyone is making this stuff anymore, and mostly we're working off of stockpiles we've squirreled away. So it's not a matter of learning the technique, it's a matter of what are you going to do with the technique after you've learned it. I will not teach people how to do dye transfer printing unless they have a stockpile of supplies already, which means I've taught one person in the last 7 years. Because everyone else who contacted me, they had no way to get the materials. And what should I do? Torture them? teach them how to do this and then say, oh, guess what, you can't ever do this again?
Well, I think people need to see a dye transfer print to actually really realize what it is. And if they want something done bad enough, well, they can pay you or someone else to make them a beautiful print.
Yes. No, they're not to be believed until they're seen. You have to see them to know how good they are. They're just amazing. But that's true of any well-made print. People who've never seen a really, really well-made photographic print in any medium get blown away when they see what a really good one looks like.
Well, it's like black and white. A lot of people now, they shoot digital, they do black and white conversion. You get some beautiful black and white prints from this current Epson technology, even the HP and the Canon stuff. I mean, anybody can get a pretty nice looking, really cool, very large latitude black and white print. But, there's still something about silver reflectivity in a traditional black and white print that you don't see on an inkjet-based print. That if you've not really held the two next to each other or been able to see the difference, you can't explain it.
Just the same way that there's some kind of ineffable and indescribable difference between a platinum print and a silver gelatin print.
Yeah.
And I can't tell you what it is, but I can tell you when I look at them. And most of the time, of course, it won't matter. But when it does, it really does. We're lucky here, actually. There's a platinum printer in San Francisco. We're the only city on Earth right now that has a dye transfer printer and a platinum printer.
And a 20x24 Polaroid instant camera.
Yeah, that too. Well-made platinum prints just have a look to them that I can't describe. I can tell you, I did tell you how dye transfers look better than other prints. I can't tell you how a platinum print looks better than other prints. I don't have the words for it. You have to see it to understand it.
But it does, though.
But that doesn't mean everyone out there should be trying to do platinum printing.
Right. It depends on what your vision is of the capture that you did at the time and what you want it to look like.
Exactly. Darkroom printing, same way. I can't say for certain what the future of color will be. Black and white darkroom printing will be around forever because those materials are so easy to make, there's never going to be someone who isn't making them. You may be buying them from some strange company in India or Southeast Asia or some unnamed nation in Africa at the moment, but you're always going to be able to get black and white darkroom materials. And they'll actually be pretty good ones, too. It's just if you're in love with DuPont Varagam, as Edward Weston was, well, you better stockpile it or you're kind of out of luck. Or you can move with the times and you can find new materials.
You can, and then there's other people like Ron Mowry that used to be at Kodak making things and doing custom emulsions for people.
Oh, Ron's a good friend of mine. Ron is a very good guy. He's incredibly helpful. Really cool fellow. One of these days we're going to meet face to face.
Now you just need him to cook up some film for you.
He's been playing with that. The reality of it is that I will probably test anything that somebody comes up with if they ask me to. But given what I'm doing and given the 24 hours in a day, I'm probably just going to keep using my Kodak stuff. I know how it works.
You know how it works, and you can only do so much. Like you said, there's only much time in a day, and there's, you have enough supply, and you keep getting lucky enough that people keep turning you on to more stuff.
Yep.
Here, take this. Thank you.
Exactly. And if at some point I finally run out, I will say to myself, well, fine, I did dye transfer for 40 years. I have a personal portfolio of over 300 prints. I have hundreds and hundreds of prints in inventory. If that's not enough, well, it's not enough. But there are few people who can say that they have that.
So true. I have one quick question here before we go is,
sure,
what does a dye transfer print look like in regards to portraiture or skin tone? Do I gain anything? A dye transfer print of the human subject, or am I going to not really see that big a deal because it's just a skin tone?
Oh, you'll see a big difference. In fact, most of the dye transfer printing I've done for other clients over the past 25 years has been portraiture. I've done a lot of printing on an ongoing basis for the Bernard Lee Schwartz Foundation. Bern Schwartz was a portrait photographer who was active in the early 80s, and he had access to a lot of high-level people in the world. So I've done prints of Alistair Cook, Prince Charles, Margot Fontaine, Lord Mountbatten, the one that ended up on the British stamp in profile.
Wow.
Any number of American noteworthies, the Pope, all of this stuff printed as dye transfer. It's been very interesting work. And, no, dye transfer is really good for portraiture because of that ability to render subtle differences in reds, oranges, and yellows.
Skin tone.
Exactly. If you want a perfectly flawless magazine-look skin tone, the kind of stuff that all that portrait software does, where every blemish and wrinkle looks away and it looks like an airbrushed Playboy photograph, no, dye transfer is not the way you want to go. If you want a realistic-looking portrait, nothing's better than dye transfer. It's just fabulously good for that. It's one of the things it does the best. In fact, one of the premier portrait studios in the country, LeClaire Studios in Michigan, used to specialize in dye transfer offerings. They would do lovely, lovely large format dye transfer prints. Luciano Studios in Kansas City closed up in the 80s. She was dye transfer and did magnificent work. She even used a one-shot camera with her most serious clients. So she was doing in-camera glass plate separations for doing dye transfer work into the 1980s.
Wow.
And that's the ultimate quality way to go.
You can still do it today. They can hire you to make a print. So if you're a portrait or wedding photographer, guess what? They can have a dye transfer print.
They can.
All you have to do is write the check.
Gary. All you have to do is write the check and work it into my schedule.
Right. Great stuff. Katarn, tell me your website. People can go look at what you're doing, look at your beautiful work. You do have prints for sale up there. I know that they missed the offer that you just did for some beautiful prints that you guys had offered at an extremely economical price that we talked about that's going to keep you busy for a while. But what do they find out about everything that you're up to? And of course, later on, we're going to talk about your digital work. You do also retouching, restoration, a lot of cool stuff there that we'll talk about on Inside Digital Photo. But just give me your website address so people can actually go look at your work. It's just beautiful stuff.
Sure. It's really simple. It's katein.com. That's C-T-E-I-N.com. And that's all it takes. Don't send email to that address. Everything that goes to that address as email goes into the Bitbucket. I do have an email address, and I have a link on the webpage where it says, contact me, and that will bring you up the right email address. But if you try sending mail to katein@katein.com, I'm never going to see it. I'm just warning people of that ahead of time, because sometimes it happens.
Right.
And that's where they can find the dye transfer stuff. They can also find links there to my books, to my monographs, to my photo restoration website. So I won't give any of that stuff, because katein.com is easy enough to remember. I would also point out that if you Google me, there are not many Kateins in the world.
No.
Google is your friend.
For you, definitely.
And yes, exactly. Thank God I'm not named Joe Smith.
There you go.
If people want to find me and they can't remember how to do it, Google me. Believe me, you'll get there.
Yeah, and they can look at your books and all the other stuff you've done. You've done some great books, and just a lot of cool work. It's just great stuff you're doing.
Thank you, thank you.
And I really appreciate joining us today on Inside Analog Photo, and we definitely look forward to having you back because we can talk about this stuff even in more detail, and I think this is just really great stuff you're doing, and I really appreciate your time today.
Well, I'm glad to be available, and it was very enjoyable chatting with you, and my greetings to all my friends in ABUG.
Well, there you go. Katine, the legendary, world-famous dye transfer printer, said to be by many the best color printer ever. I'm your host, Scott Shepard, on Inside Analog Photo. I'd like to thank the sponsors of the Inside Analog Photography radio program, Fujifilm, over at FujifilmUSA.com/professional, making life more colorful. Richard Photo Lab, of course, at RichardPhotoLab.com and Upstrap at Upstrap-Pro.com. And our media partners of the Analog Photography User Group over at www.apug.org. And I've been your host, Scott Shepard, here on Inside Analog Photo. You can find out more information over at www.insideanalogphoto.com. We'll be back next week with more great analog photography.